Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Bernstein. I have the privilege of serving as the Dean of Pardes and also the privilege of welcoming to our Beit Midrash a very illustrious panel tonight. Two of whom are our very own faculty members, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Reifman and Rabbi Rachel Berkovitz. But I also want to express our feeling of honor to have Rabbi Dov Linzer of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah and Professor Daniel Sperber here in our Beit Midrash. Pardes and Yeshivat Chovevei Torah have had a long symbiotic relationship. More than a few YCT Musmachim have been Pardes graduates who've continued their learning at Chovevei Torah, including the dean of Chovevei Torah, Rabbi John Kelson. We take enormous pride here at Pardes in these graduates and other graduates who've continued their Torah learning and have made enormous contributions to Jewish life in North America as well as in Israel and in Europe as well. 5 years ago, Chovevei Torah and Pardes actually cemented and formalized our relationship so as to better serve Pardes students who aspire to continue to learn at YCT. And we're pleased to have cemented that relationship even further with an inauguration of a new collaboration between YCT and the Pardes Center for Jewish Educators. Anybody who might be interested in moving on from Pardes to YCT is welcome to speak to Rabbi Dr. Reifman, and we'll be happy to explain that collaboration and the benefits of studying both at Pardes and YCT as well. I'm going now to give the microphone over to Rabbi Reifman, who will make a more formal introduction of our speakers.
First of all, I just want to again welcome our very illustrious panel. Rabbi Dov Linzer is somebody I've had the great pleasure and honor to work with for many years. His wife, Rabbi Dvorah Vlachauer, hired me on a whim about 20 years ago. Since then, I've had really the great pleasure to learn with and from both Rabbi Vlachauer and Rabbi Dov Linzer. And I am now the Chovevei Torah Pardes liaison. I teach here, but also work for Chovevei Torah in Israel, and I'm very glad to be moderating tonight's panel. Rabbi Rachel Berkovitz is a very treasured colleague of mine here at Pardes. She's somebody who I work with, share students with all the time, and I'm very, very glad that this year she was able to join us on the panel and did not suffer any unusual personal difficulties. Last year's mishap will go unmentioned. And lastly, Rabbi Daniel Sperber is somebody who I've also had the pleasure to learn from at the Bar-Ilan Kollel and Bar-Ilan University. Rabbi Sperber is an enormously erudite and well-respected scholar in the area of halakha and history of halakha, and we are really very, very blessed that he has agreed to speak and share with his wisdom with us this evening. The topic of tonight's panel is something that we spoke about a great deal before the panel to think about exactly how we wanted to frame the issue, but I think the topic of other religions and halakha. The topic of other religions and halakha is an issue of really very contemporary concern for two reasons. First of all, in the global community that we live, we come into contact with a greater and greater number of religions. I think growing up in suburban New Jersey in the 1980s, the most exotic religionists I came in contact with were Presbyterians. And now my hometown is home to a significant population of Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, and that's true all over the globe. In Israel, it's also of particular concern because being blessed with a Jewish state for the first time in 2,000 years, we are now in a position of power and also responsibility to determine what role other religions will have in a Jewish society. So it's with these issues in mind that I now turn to our panelists, who will each take a few minutes to share how they see the issue of how halacha relates to other religions. And then we'll follow that up with another round of comments from each of the panelists about specific halacha questions that they see as particularly pressing in this day and age. Rabbi Dov Lindzer.
Thank you again. It's really wonderful to be here and to be. Is this working? Okay, and to be participating, partnering with Pardes, and to really see the wonderful turnout that we have, and the great honor to be sharing the panel with such illustrious figures and good friends. The issue of relationship to other religions, and you know, starts sort of halachically with the concept of avodah zarah. This week is Parshat Vayitro, which you shall not have any gods before me. The prohibition about worshiping other gods and worshiping idols, that sort of frames, I think, initially the way we looked at all other religions. Of course, that was at a time when the world was pagan and idolatrous, and then became a whole question about how do you transfer those categories when the religions that you're seeing are not exactly pagan and idolatrous. And I should say, you know, that there are, I think, two basic questions or directions in which this goes. One is, in general, you know, our attitude towards what I'll call, quote unquote, the outside world. It's never like Jews actually lived completely, you know, in hermetically sealed communities, divorced from the outside world. We're always being influenced by our larger surrounding. But nevertheless, there's this perception of the outside world. And do we see that as you know, something that is fundamentally threatening, and we have to build as sort of as protective shields as possible? Do we see it something that there are areas that one needs to be careful about, but fundamentally you don't need to sort of see this as a huge sort of threat and sort of total separation? And I would also say, you know, what develops over time, and maybe even in the time of the rabbis, actually things that are some very positive about that larger world that we should be engaging. So that's not really yet the question of other religions, but they inform one another. The tract in the Gemara called Avodah Zarah, which is about, you know, idol worship, is surprisingly very little actually about idol worship. The third chapter is about the status of actual idols, but not actually about the worship of idols. And the first two chapters are really about how do we negotiate living in a society which we're the minority religion. This is, of course, very relevant to those of us not living in Israel, and what it means in terms of the larger non-Jewish society. And it's not all about threats of idolatry, non-kosher food, bad influences, you know, different values, and so on. And I think what sort of certainly emerges from a close read of those chapters is that there were, not surprisingly, different attitudes among the rabbis, some that saw that world as deeply threatening and wanted to sort of create as high as barriers as possible, you know, and others that sort of saw much good in that world, or at least certainly, you know, nothing that one needs to be super fearful of, but there are particular things that you need to stay away from. And the particular things that you need to stay away from usually were those things that were relating to the world of idolatry. So I think that's one question in general, which is sort of a general orientation. When we get to the actual issue of Avodah Zarah and idolatry, you know, the surprising thing is that the rabbis never saw a need to precisely define what type of religion is considered avodah zarah, probably because, you know, it was all around them. You know, you only need to define it precisely when there are more gray cases. And, you know, so then when you started having the Christianity come up, the question came, should that really be defined as avodah zarah? And it's important to know that there are sort of like two categories, one which focuses on the use of images, right, and the other that focuses on a sense of a worship of other gods. And without going through the whole sort of halachic development of that, the general approach of the Rishonim, and probably already starting from the Gemara, was that, yes, it did fall into the category of Avodah Zarah, for both because certainly prior to Protestantism, you know, the use of statues and images in worship, you know, was very prevalent, even though the Church said, you know, I mean, it's an interesting difference between Eastern Orthodox and, you know, the Roman Catholic, but, you know, that these weren't actually the same as idols, as if God embodied you know, was embodied in them, but nevertheless were sort of, you know, and more for inspiration. But nevertheless, the use of these images was very prevalent. And also ideas around incarnation and so on, also a very embodied idea of God. I completely reject those that say, oh, Christianity was considered avodah zarah because Trinity is like three and polytheism. That's not the halachic definition of avodah zarah. The halachic definition of avodah zarah is either a worship of God through images or a worship of an other God, a different God. It's not about three or one or so on. And the general feeling was that one way or another, Christianity fell into this category. And even with the advent of Protestantism, that was the sense, even though there were no images, the idea of an incarnate God, the idea of a Trinity without calling it multiple gods, but it was still such a profoundly different understanding of God that it was not seen of as the Jewish God. What was interesting is that sometimes the Rishonim said that when they pray to God the Father, there's a lot more overlap with that sense of worshiping the same God. Anyway, that was the general approach. What happened was that because of initially socioeconomic pressures with all of these limits with interacting with people that are seen as worshipers of Avodah Zarah and the realities that created in terms of barriers with operating with Christians, that caused the Rishonim, particularly the Tosafists, to reframe exactly what the issue was and to say, well, maybe Christianity is Avodah Zarah, but the Christians aren't Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They're not so sincere. You need a Talmud to make that type of difference, right? So the religion is Avodah Zarah, but they're not actually worshippers of Avodah Zarah. Maybe they don't really buy into all of that stuff, which is quite ironic and more than a little patronizing. But it allowed a distinction between saying that the religion is forbidden. We're not saying we're okay with that religion, that we're theologically comfortable with it, but we are okay doing business with and interacting with. And I actually feel that there's something powerful about that because, you know, and this is going to be my larger theme, that the whole question becomes, and also the title of the class, right, tolerance, togetherness, and so on. How do we adopt a position of pluralism, tolerance, and so on without it slipping into relativism, without it being, you know, well, we all more or less, what was the story they told about Bertrand Russell where he was a conscientious objector to war and they asked him what his religion was and he said, like, agnostic. So I said, agnostic? How do you spell it? A-G? And he said, well, he says, I guess as long as we all worship the same God. So, you know, and I think that that's like a problem that we have, that I think that in this type of a world that we live in, do we have a strong sense of that, you know, of our... that of a sense of like we really deeply believe in certain theological principles, you know, or do we just sort of feel this is our lifestyle and other people have different lifestyles and it's all sort of relative? So I think the idea of having that the religion is still problematic but the people are not actually was a nice way of striking a balance. And then that developed even later to an idea that Christianity is not Avodah Zarah for non-Jews, but it is Avodah Zarah for Jews, which is even better, which is I don't judge, you know, anybody who has a different religion than me. But for me as a Jew, I feel that that is actually totally off limits. And that will lead to a conclusion. I once said, you know, we have students out there, rabbis who, you know, once their synagogue burned down or whatever it was under construction and the local church let them use a school building for prayer services. And then when a church burnt down in the neighborhood or whatever, I don't remember the exact specifics. Anyway, the question was, could they help donate money in rebuilding of the church? So I said, yes, Christianity is not, it's good that Christians, you know, have a church and we want to support that and it's not problematic for non-Jews, so I totally support that. But on the other hand, and I got totally pilloried for that in the Haredi press, as you might imagine, but at the other hand, I don't walk into a Catholic church and certainly not into the sanctuary, because for Jews it's still Avodah Zarah. And I feel that that it creates an interesting balance of saying, I deeply believe in what I believe in and am committed to it, and I think that there are red lines. And at the other hand, adopting a sort of non-judgmental stance vis-a-vis, you know, others. And that, I think, is my sort of general orientation to this. The one thing, and I'll end with, because my guess is my time was already over, the one thing that I'll end with is, you can tell me when my time is over. The one thing that I'll end with is saying that I do acknowledge that the term Avodah Zarah is not value neutral. And it does come with a lot of sense of, like, you know, pagan, idolatrous. It really just means foreign worship, a worship, you know, but nevertheless, I don't know exactly how to overcome that challenge, but I do think that the stance I'm looking for, a halachic and an attitudinal stance, is one that is non-judgmental towards others, but for ourselves says that there are serious theological commitments and serious red lines. So that's in terms of a general approach.
One has to read those verses very carefully in order to understand what they're saying. Not just against the background of paganism that surrounded them. It appears that one of the commandments speaks about monotheism in the sense that it says you shouldn't have other gods. That means you can worship me, but if you think that just across the border there's another one who's also a deity, that is a way of understanding the first, that particular commandment. The next commandment talks about images. You're not meant to have images, but you're not meant to have images which you worship. After all, in the temple itself, in the next few parashiyot, we learn about the kruvim, and then not long afterwards we read about the snake, the serpent, the brazen serpent. So images were somehow or other not altogether forbidden, but they were forbidden within a certain context. Over the years, these slight differences became somewhat blurred. But I think that when we speak about, this is a very generalized title, and I think that we have to try to point out the real complexity of the subject. Firstly, there's a radical difference between the different religions that we're talking about. Obviously, our relationship to Islam is different from our relationship to Christianity, because Islam appears to be a strictly monotheistic religion, whereas Christianity, as you've already heard, is a more problematic case. But again, we already heard that there are two different issues involved. There's an issue of the sort of belief in a single God, and there's also the issue of image worship. And that means that we have to separate again the relationship between Catholicism and Protestantism, which should have a different halakhic status. And then, of course, there are religions which are further away from us. Hinduism, Buddhism. There are relatively few early texts dealing with these because the early authorities didn't really know too much about them. Sadhya Gaon gives a few references to the Indians, but they didn't really know too much about it. And there's a whole different mindset in the East, which is difficult for a Westerner to comprehend. So we see that, first of all, there's a complexity in the very definition of whom we're going to relate to. Then there's another degree of complexity. There's a difference between what the sacred texts say and how they were subsequently interpreted. And the classic problem, which is an intra-Jewish problem, is whether God, the single unitary God that we believe in, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, can appear in physical form or not. And that, as is well known, was a major machloket, difference of opinion between the Rambam and the Ravid. And the Ravid, when the Rambam makes it very clear that God can never appear in any physical form, Ein lo hagshama, and this appears in the a number of different places in the Rambam, the Ravid says, but there were quite significant authorities that disagree with you. And we actually know who those authorities were. And that, again, triggered off a whole series of discussions. So that even within Judaism were different notions of understanding the nature of Godhead. So the texts, the biblical texts, have a great deal of anthropomorphisms. The hand of God, the arm of God, the face of God, and so on and so forth. Were they to be taken literally or not? Obviously, we know that the major authorities took them as not to be interpreted, not to be understood literally. But that was not always the case of all Jewish thinkers in the medieval period. So, and it's the same thing with other religions. The sacred texts may say something, but then they may be interpreted subsequently over the ages by the major interpreters in a totally different fashion. So, if you think of Hinduism, for example, which would seem to be the most idolatrous religion that you people would ever come into contact with, the sacred texts appear to be so, but they have been interpreted over the last 1,500 years, no, 2,500 years, I should say, as not being idolatrous in any sense. Then there's another problem to take into account, and that's that there's a difference between what the religious leaders of a religion, the rabbis, the clergy, the theologians, the swamis and the acharyas say that their religion means, and what the common people say. And there can be a great gulf between these two understandings of the same religion. So, some Oriental Jews, North African Jews, will go and pray traditionally at the tombs of deceased rabbis, and they dorshe meitim, which is something completely forbidden according to biblical law. And of course, that would be interpreted completely differently by their own religious leaders. So there's a problem of how we relate to different trends within our own religion. There's problems of how we relate to different religions, each one in its own right, and maybe one religion with its different sects. And there's the problem of how we relate to the difference between the official theology and the practical religion and ritual. So I'm just trying to show that this is not a simple issue. And all these different areas of complexity have their own halachic approaches. So I just wanted to muddle you up.
Thank you. I made the mistake of asking to speak last because I thought that you guys were going to speak very technically and halachically, and then I was going to speak very broadly. But apparently I was wrong, and you've said a lot of the things I planned to say. So I'm going to still say some of them, but hopefully with a slightly different emphasis and nuance. Maybe this was a no-brainer, was going to quote from this week's Parsha and quote from the Aseret HaDibrot from the Ten Commandments. And literally the first thing that the divine HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the Jewish people in speaking directly to them is to identify that the divine is God, took us out of Egypt, and you should not have any other gods. And this is the premise that the entire covenant is built on, fidelity to the one God. This is said, I think it's clear from looking at the Torah, in a polytheistic reality. There seems to be acknowledgement that there could be other gods. It's just that you have to be faithful to this one God and not be in relationship with anyone else. And I think our tradition looks at Avram Avinu as our main fourth father, the first person who is in relationship and covenant with the divine, and puts on him as if his whole battle was against idolatry and coming to this view of the one God. And this obviously is played out in all the prophets, this battle between, is the Jewish people going to be faithful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or are they going to stray and be in relationship with other gods? And I think that Chazal in some ways continues on this spectrum. The rabbis of the Mishnah live in a time period where the mythology, like the mythology of the Greek and Roman gods, is the reality that they live in. There's their God, and then there's other people's gods. And they too, in their entire tractate, as Dov mentioned, aren't so concerned with the theological questions or the practical questions so much of practice. They're interested in relationships between Jews and the other. For me, I see it as they're very interested in this identity marker. What are the boundaries? How do I know that I'm in our society and I can identify as a Jew? And where do I stray too far and cross that line? And clearly, Avodah Zarah is a main definer of that identity. For me, you mentioned this a little bit at the end of, I think the concept of foreign worship or strange service has negative connotations. Avodah Zarah is considered the greatest sin that a Jew can do. It signals that this is completely off limits. It's beyond the pale. There might be something wrong about it, repulsive, abhorrent, strange. I think it delegitimizes, that it has a language of delegitimization. It means there's nothing of spiritual value inherent in this, if we say it's Avodah Zarah. There's nothing to be learned from it. And I think there's a certain mockery of it, of kind of, it's just so ridiculous. I think we see that in the Nevi'im and the prophets where it's just stones and wood, and it's just ridiculous that you would believe in an idol, through to, unfortunately, in the modern day, in places where other religions are still looked at like that in the Jewish world. And so, as you mentioned, when Western religions suddenly come on the scene in which they are other but yet don't believe in many gods, this is a challenge to Judaism. What do I do with this? How do I look at this? And I had thought you would have already discussed some of the ways the Rishonim grapple with this. I think they've been mentioned. Obviously, there's clear definition. People have something to say. I think Christianity is Avodah Zarah. I don't think Islam is. Or maybe I should look at Christianity this way. Maybe I can see it as Avodah Zarah for them and not for me. Or the Miri saying, oh, maybe it isn't Avodah Zarah at all. I'm going to look at it differently. And clearly, the Rishonim and the halachists grapple with this issue. And when halachists deal with this issue today, I think they do the normative halachic thing. They look back to those texts for models. And they say, well, the Rambam says Christianity is Avodah Zarah, so it must be Avodah Zarah. Or Tosfot said, this is how we can imagine it so we can do business with them, so let's work with this. And this is the part where I think I'll differ. I feel discomfort with that for two reasons, and I want to share them with you. One is something personal, and one is something about halachic methodology. The personal thing I see is that the real threat to religion today, I think, is secularism. I don't think we have the taiva, the desire for Avodah Zarah, doesn't exist. In the ancient world, everyone believed in God. It just was, which God were you going to believe in? Today, not many people believe in God, actually. And the threat is, does God exist? Can you prove it to me? Or I don't even ask those questions. It's obvious to me that God doesn't. And when I meet religious people, religious leaders and religious people, I actually feel much more connected to them than the other of secularism. They don't feel other to me. They feel the same to me. They're people that are committed to living a religious lifestyle, for looking for the divine in this world. And I feel connected to them. I feel similar to them. I feel like I want to talk to them. I want to engage with them. I want to understand them. I want to learn from them. And possibly I want to work with them to build a better world. And I think for even lay Christians that I meet, my gut, when I talk in a gut, is I don't think of them as idolatrous. Because for me, idolatry is a laden word. It has all those negative connotations, and I don't see them. They look similar to me. And maybe that's part of the threat, but we'll come to that. That's thing one from a personal perspective. Thing two is I believe halacha evolves with the times. And I believe that one should be constantly rethinking, how does this apply to modern day? What has changed? What needs to change? How does it look now that is different than ancient times? Just as in the way I wouldn't, although I respect, look to what medieval poskim say about the status of women, I don't take for granted what they say is true about how I should view women within halacha today. So for me, it's the same thing. I can listen to what they said about Christianity or other religions, and I can hear it. But the question is, does that reflect what Christianity or other religions are today? I'm even suspicious about how much they really understood about other religions in their day. But maybe that's a little bit too not nice of me. I believe, as you mentioned, that Judaism has evolved. Our view of God has evolved. The view of God in the Torah is different than the way the Rambam conceptualizes it. So I assume that other religions and their theology must have evolved. And so whatever it was in the Middle Ages must be different than it is today. And the only way to truly understand what it is would be to talk to them, and to investigate and to ask them. And by just looking at it, obviously you can jump to incorrect conclusions. I mean, imagine if you were beamed into a shul on Sukkot and watched people shake the lulav in all directions. You could assume something crazy, something idolatrous has happened until you actually spoke to someone and they gave you an example. You could watch Hotza'at Sefer Torah, someone taking out the Torah and carrying it around and walking with it and kissing it. You could think we worship the Torah unless you talked to someone and really understood the depth of what was going on. And the moon. And many other things. But obviously we know when talking about our own religion that you really have to understand what's going on. I assume the same should be for other religions. And the question, similar to what I would have that you mentioned, is how should we go about doing that? Who should we ask? Should it be the lay people? Should it be the leaders? Right? Obviously, if you ask a lay Jew something versus a rabbi or a Jew from one denomination versus another denomination, you're going to get completely different stories of what true Judaism is. And so that part I am not clear about. One thought that I have that is interesting to me, I'm curious of what my esteemed panelists feel, is that possibly there is a special role for Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Because here, as being the majority culture, we don't have a fear as much of this, what if we become like them? What if we get diluted by them? We feel confidence in, I hope, in who we are and what we believe. And I don't think, it doesn't surprise me when I was, I don't know that much about Hinduism, and I thought, I know Rav Sperber is an expert on it, and I thought he was going to talk about it, so I tried to research it. But what I found out is there's Rav Sperber, and there's Alon Goshen Gottstein, and there's Rav Hefter, and there's Rav Steinzelt. Every person that I found who was interested in writing about Judaism and Hinduism lives in Israel. And that was interesting to me. I don't know if it's because, and there was a delegation of rabbis that went to meet Hindu leaders, and I'm curious if that's because when you come from a place of confidence where there isn't a threat, when you don't feel that there's really a taiva, a desire for the other, you can be more open. I'm coming to my end. I'm probably way over the time. I thought by now someone would have mentioned the Meiri. And I wanted to say, okay, well, I thought I needed you to mention him so I could say something different about him. But people like to quote the Meiri because they say that he thinks that Christianity isn't Avodah Zarah. So I like the Meiri, but not just because of that. because of his methodology, if you look through his commentary and he talks about other religions in 20, 30 places throughout, like he clearly has a clear methodology in dealing with them. His explanations understand that religion evolves and that the Avodah Zarah or the other religions, he doesn't think it's Avodah Zarah, that he sees in his day are not the same as the ancient ones that the rabbis were talking about. He understands that other faiths and other people can have moral values, that they can create meaning in their lives and they can help build society. I mean, these are language that he used to explain why they're different, that they are come within the category of people that have religion and therefore they are not immoral. And I think that this type of outlook of looking at the other and seeing the good in them or looking at them as not objectively wrong or abhorrent or all those negative words is very, very important to be able to see what we respect in them. I just want to end by quoting from Rabbi Sacks because I am worried that within the Jewish world, we still very strongly fall on the side of non-tolerance, but fear of the other. And so I just want to read what Rabbi Sacks says in his very important book, The Dignity of Difference. Got to get the glasses. He says the following, and this I'm ending. He said, religion can be a source of discord. It can also be a form of conflict resolution. We are familiar with the former. The second is far too little tried. Yet it's here, if anywhere, that hope must lie if we are to create a human solidarity strong enough to bear the strains that lie ahead. The great faiths must now become an active force for peace and for justice and compassion, on which peace ultimately depends. That will require great courage and perhaps something more than courage, a candid admission that more than at any other time in the past, we need to search each faith in its own way for a way of living with and acknowledging the integrity of those who are not of our faith. Can we make space for difference? Can we hear the voice of God in a language, a sensibility, a culture not our own? Can we see the presence of God in the face of a stranger? And then he continues later on. The supreme religious challenge is to see God's image in one who is not in our image.
Thank you very much. I now want to ask our panelists to reflect on some specific practical questions that come up regarding other religions. Before I do so, I just want to make a note of, I think, an important distinction that's already emerged in some of the comments and will no doubt emerge in some of these halakhic considerations. And that is a distinction between two sorts of issues that we have when we confront other religions. One, which several of you noted was prevalent in biblical times and I think in the rabbinic period and even in the Middle Ages, was a concern of assimilation into other religions. And therefore, the rabbis and even the Torah institute certain boundaries between Judaism and other religions. That's a very inward kind of focus. There was also, as several of you discussed, an objective problem with idolatry, an objective definition of idolatry, and much of Tractate of Avodah Zarah is also dedicated to concerns that we don't want idolaters to worship idolatry. To what extent are the issues that come up with regard to other religions also about bring the world closer to the worship of the God that we believe in?
I can't resist. I will definitely get too practical, but I can't resist making a few brief comments about. Is this microphone working?
Hold it close to your mouth.
Okay, that's better. Some very quick comments about some of the issues that were raised. I totally agree with the sentiment of Jonathan Sacks. My concern is that we're living, at least let me start this way, and this has also to maybe do with minority culture and with sort of a more liberal end of a community. I feel that the concern is not that the threat is a ta'ava, a lust, a desire to be attracted to the other religion, like the same way the threat is not, you know, the worship of many gods. The threat is a threat of relativism. That's what I'm concerned about. So it's and that's why I feel that at least the community that I'm dealing with, the what needs to be sort of more cultivated, or what needs to be more pursued, is not greater sense of tolerance and collaboration and cooperation, but a sense of that there actually are some lines and it's not all the same. So I think it's a question of what do you think is the threat and where do you think the work needs to get done. I think that's like important. And yes, I do think there's a difference in Israel, I think, as a majority religion, and maybe I'm going to get attacked for this, but my sense is that people are tend to be more religious in Israel, and I don't mean more observant. I mean, like a real sort of deep feeling of religiosity. And so that's what I think actually are some differences. And therefore, I do think, at least from where I'm coming from, drawing some lines are important. I acknowledge, you know, the challenge that Avodah Zarah is a very negatively loaded term. So I think I would rather focus on certain halachot. You know, you don't go into, the sanctuary of a Catholic church without the need to be calling it Avodah Zarah. And I would just say that I know people from other religions. I know a rabbi who he did, when this is now I'm getting to practical application, who did not go to the funeral of the mother of a close colleague of his because it was in a church. But what he did was he stood outside the church for the entire hour that the funeral was going on to sort of give his condolences when they came in and to be there when they came out. And he said that created, you know, what was communicated to him, such a Kiddush Hashem, because it showed how deeply he respected, and they also respected that he was sort of being true to his religious lines. So I think that there's a real way that a person can sort of strike this type of a balance, and I am less concerned what we're communicating to others and more what we communicate to ourselves. You know, that if I'm not going to go in there, it depends what my attitude is, but am I communicating to myself because I think that it's disgusting what they do, or because I actually have my own deep theological convictions? So that's just sort of my starting point, and therefore I think I'm working in a slightly different direction. So if I want to now talk about, yes, some practical. Oh, we're doing response? Okay. All right. I think that, so I'm looking here at a list of some questions we came up with, and one of them exactly was this about attending a wedding or a funeral or so on. I make distinctions here around some technical considerations. I think Catholic Church is more problematic because of the images. I think that a Protestant church or whatever, when it's is less of an issue, or it's really not an issue if it's clear that a person isn't going in there to worship. You're going in there because it's a concert going on, or something of that nature. But even in the case of a Catholic church, you know, under some circumstances, look, we can deal with cases about somebody whose, you know, mother isn't Jewish or father isn't Jewish, right, and that they are Jewish, and what are you supposed to do, not go to the funeral? I mean, there are things to rely on. There's the Meiri's position to rely on. There's a position to rely on that even though there are images, that's obviously not the same as an idol, and they're not objects of worship, and the church isn't considered an extension of it, and so on. So I obviously do understand sort of the range that exists within halacha, and, you know, I believe that I am properly responsive in the right situations, but, you know, my starting point is to think that there are lines that need to be drawn. I will tell you that a student of mine once said to me, like, Rabbi Linzer, I have the following situation, I forget what it was, one situation like this, you know, a wedding, a funeral, or whatever it was, and can I go into the church? And I said, are you sure you want to ask me? I mean, you might want to be asking somebody else. He goes, you'll get a better answer. So he said, you know, if you want somebody to tell you it's permissible, you might want to ask somebody. He says, no, I want to ask you, because I really want to know, like, based on your considerations, which side of the line you think that this falls on. I also do want to say that I think that sometimes it's not a question of the church. You know, sometimes there's a question about what's the difference between being a spectator and a participant, right? If we all stand at a certain time and sit at a certain time, and we're now about to read from the following thing, we're now about to do communion, whatever we're going to do, at what stage, if you're there, I don't even care where you're there, be it outside, is your being there as an observer, or being there as a participant? I think that's something that we also have to look at. I'm sure there's a lot of other things to say, but I'm probably used up my time, and I'm sure issues will come up in the questions.
What were the questions?
So here are some of the examples that we had identified.
Mm-hmm.
There was...
Yeah, you can talk about Hinduism.
Talk about Hinduism.
I'll start by saying, I think Hinduism is a Vodasara.
Now you can respond. Now you can respond.
Like, you're here. Talk about Hinduism.
I want to say in advance that I'm a regular visitor to the Vatican, and that for the last 20-something years I've been involved in interreligious dialogue with both Catholics and Anglicans. And when the new Archbishop of Canterbury was going to be enthroned, that's the technical term, in Westminster Abbey, the Anglican Church approached the Israeli rabbinate and the foreign ministry and asked that a representative come from Israel. And of course, most of the rabbis refused, and I went. And I sat in the crypt, and I was there throughout the whole of that ceremony in a hat and tzitzis, and I think it was a Kiddush Hashem. And I think they appreciated it a great deal. Similarly, I've crisscrossed the whole of the Middle East, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other countries which I won't mention for various reasons. And I used to sit on the bus, and five times a day, these are long journeys from one city to another, five times a day, everybody got out of the bus, took out the little carpets, prostrated themselves, and I stood up, and they looked very baleful me, actually. They didn't like it. But I think that's the position of an Orthodox Jew. He shouldn't be frightened. We're not in medieval times when Jews were burnt at the stake. We're no longer frightened of standing up for our views, and therefore we can give them ourselves a greater degree of lassitude in our relationships to other religions. I think it's very important that we understand other religions. A very strange, anomalous situation has developed. Christianity was our enemy. We were burnt at the stake. We were driven out of countries. There were pogroms regularly through Eastern Europe. Islam, which is a monotheistic religion, was much more accommodating. The Jews in Iraq, and Syria, and other such Islamic countries, or Morocco, led a relatively good life. The situation has changed radically in the 20th century. Catholics are now our filial brothers since Nostra Aetate in 1965. We do not have inter-religious discussions, we have intra-religious discussions. Islam, on the other hand, is our mortal enemy for the radical Islam. So, we must be aware of the shifting tides of time in our relationships to other religions. I don't know why you all want to hear about Hinduism, but let's leave it to the next round.
No.
Okay. So I'll tell you a story. Many, many years ago, over 50 years ago, I served as a rabbi in Calcutta. I'd been in India many times before that as a backpacker, but I got this job as a young rabbi in the Baghdadi Jewish community of Calcutta. I lived in the house of a very wealthy person who was the head of the community, and he had two kitchens. One kitchen had meat in it, and that was run by a Muslim called Babaji. And one kitchen was a pure vegetarian one, and I've been a vegetarian for over 70 years. And it was run by a Hindu called Sona. And of course, being a vegetarian, I only ate
from the kitchen of Sona. And I thought afterwards to myself, how strange. I eat the food that's produced by an idolater, and I don't eat the food that's produced by a monotheist. And then I realized that I really didn't understand the situation at all. And in the year 2007, a group of us from the Foreign Office and from the Israeli Rabbinate were invited to go to India, to Delhi, to meet with leaders of the Hindu Dharma Acharya and to discuss our relationships with one another. And since I was the only person there among the group of rabbis that had any background to India, I was asked to begin, and I said that I found myself in a very embarrassing situation because according to Jewish law, one is not allowed to even enter a city that has idolaters and idols. And I see that in every street corner, in every crossroad, every park, every little shop front, there's a little idol or there's a big idol, the huge colored idols. And in the morning I see people prostrating to the river Ganga, pujas, and in the evening to the setting sun. And how can I, as an Orthodox Jew, be in this place with you? And therefore I said, we find ourselves in a very difficult situation. And the head of the Indian delegation, who is no longer with us, who was a great man called Swami Dayananda Saraswati, and he was a chairperson of an organization which united the different temples. And when we talk of a temple, we're not talking about a shul with 300 members. We're talking about a temple with 10 million members. And he was the chairperson of this organization, which probably numbered sometimes 500 or 600 million individuals. These are the numbers we're speaking about. And he said, you don't understand us. We do not worship idols. And we do not think there are many gods. We know there is only one God. They don't like the use of the word one because it's a limiting term. There is a supreme being called Brahma. But he has different aspects. Just as you have Midat HaRachamim, Midat HaDin, you have different names, Hashem, Elohim, Shaddai, El. We also give them different names for different aspects. The Creator, He who keeps things going, the Destroyer, Krishna, Shiva, Brahman. But it's all one unitary being. But it's very difficult for a person to imagine or to have any comprehension of such a unitary being, entity. And therefore we need objects on which we can fasten our attention in order to rise above them to some sort of connection, some sort of dveikut, some sort of hit'alut ha-nefesh with the divine being, the creator, the preserver, and the destroyer. But you too, I remember from your Bible, because he was a very knowledgeable person, knew that the once in your Bible there's a story of a brazen serpent, and when the people had a plague, they made this brazen serpent and they prayed to it. And what does the Midrash say? V'chi nachash memit, v'chi nachash mekayem, ela bizman shebnei Yisrael mechavnim et libam klape mala. Kadosh Baruch Hu, mevi laim ruch refuah. We too. Do you really think that a linga, which is just a pile of stone, is something that we believe has some sort of divinity? It has the same divinity as everything in the whole universe, because the whole universe is divine. Because God is both transcendent and immanent, and that we believe in too. And our temples have some degree of sanctity, just as your synagogues have some degree of sanctity. And therefore we have to be respectful to them. But we don't worship the objects that are in them. We concentrate on them. And maybe some of you people do yoga. Maybe some of you know that one of the exercises of yoga is to sit cross-legged with your hands in a particular position, and you look at a little black spot. And you look, and you look, and you look, and that spot disappears. It's no longer there. And you're breathing slowly. And then you suddenly are transported into a sort of a different realm. And that is what we do in our pujas. We try to transcend ourselves so that we can get beyond. Because we're aware that the world is... there's a curtain. And that curtain, you have to get beyond it. So I see Hinduism as far closer to being a monotheistic religion than even Christianity.
What do you mean by then even Christianity? Because Christianity what?
Because Christianity is, because Catholic Christianity is Trinitarian, and it believes that God appeared at one stage in a human image. And that is not something that I find easy. And I don't know what the Holy Ghost is. That's something that's beyond me. But the Trinity in Catholic Trinity is not the same as the Hindu Trimurti, which is the same word.
Okay. I'll say one thing that this being on this panel made me think about. And I told Dove I wanted to raise the issue and have one of the questions be like Jews' relationship, and I was thinking particularly in America, to Halloween, to Christmas. Could you go? Dove's the whole time been just talking about don't going into a church, but could you go to a Christmas party? Could you go to a Christmas dinner? Could you go to a Halloween party? Could you go out trick-or-treating? And I saw within myself that on the one hand, as I told you, I feel very open to respecting other religions and seeing the good in them. And I don't, and a gut feeling... feel that they're idolatrous. I'm curious if you like delved into what the Trinity means or what the Son being holy is with religious leaders in the Christian faith as much as you have in the Hindu faith. I've not spoken to any religious leaders in any faith, but I do see that when I speak to religious Christians, they 100% express to me that they believe in the same God that we do, and that just because when I look at the Trinity and I see a human being and Jesus, and then I say, I don't get it. How can you like worship God in a human being? Obviously, they're looking at it some other way that's different than this and don't see him as a human being and see it as a part and parcel. I understood it similar to what you just said, that Hinduism feels similar to us, that there's like these different aspects of how God manifests in the world. But and so on one hand, I have a very much openness to try to understand that, to respect that. But in my gut, when I hear about what I see as a phenomenon, and I see this from speaking to students and speaking to my siblings in America, that there's an idea that all these Christian holidays have sort of become secular, and this is what it means to be American, and it's perfectly fine. Like, no one even thinks of Halloween as something not American. When I say to people, isn't that pagan or isn't that Christian? They're like, what are you talking about, Rachel? Like, what are you talking about? It's just totally a fun thing to do. And I don't know if it's because I have the baggage of growing up as an Orthodox Jew in America where these were very clear identity markers for us, and like we did not go out trick-or-treating, and like I suffered all those years not having the fun. And so I've like incorporated that it is something. But what I think for me, and this maybe relates to something you said, Dove, is that it's not about if I think there's something wrong in the way they worship or if there's something different. I think it's about the importance for me of Jewish identity and of being knowledgeable about your tradition and being committed to your tradition. And so even if another religion I say is monotheistic and isn't a Vodazara, I think I do still feel discomfort with the ideas that Jews would then go and do those acts, meaning it's good. I respect that there's what to learn from it, but I very much feel discomfort with the idea that I'm going to like try that, or I want to be that, or it looks fun, so I want to do it, and I'm missing out. And I guess I was trying to like think more clearly about it. I think there would be a difference between, like, if you had a very close friend who was Christian and they invited you to their Christmas party, and then you invited them to your Hanukkah party, and each one knew that they were going to the other's party, like, as the other faith, but because you wanted to participate with them because you have a relationship of caring between you, then what I do see sometimes of people just wanting to be part of that culture. This is what American culture is, and it looks fun, and what's wrong with it, and I want to be it, and that I do worry. I know it's like not a popular thing to say for all my students who are listening, but you'll tell me that when I try to talk to people, they say it's not a threat, it's not anything, but in my gut, I feel that there is some threat to Jewish continuity, to Jewish identity that concerns me, that really isn't about the other, but is about us, that it maybe represents that you see something lacking in Judaism that isn't satisfying that need for you, and that is why you're seeking something else, and therefore I'm worried, and I guess that's why I'm in Torah education, but it does worry me. I want to ask you guys a question, if I could take the conversation somewhere else, because I feel like if I'm on the panel with esteemed Talmidei Chachamim, I should get to ask my questions. I'm curious of what you think about the fact that we don't have Kohanim marry converts, because we're stuck with the idea about how non-Jews behave that was from the time period of Chazal, i.e. that they are all sexually promiscuous, immoral, etc., when obviously our views of the other religion have changed, and this is something that causes a lot of pain in the Jewish world. I'm curious if you think that is something that could be rethought. That's thing number one. I'm interested to hear what you think about wine and non-Jews. I'm sorry, I'm throwing these on your thing. And last thing I'm interested to ask you, Dov, who seems to have clear view of, I guess both of you, of Christianity being a Avodah Zarah. Not for non-Jews, but for Jews, meaning you keep talking about going into a church or a specific type of church. I feel like, at least what I know of American politics, there is a lot of Christian theology ideology that is brought in, particularly in some ways positive attitudes towards Israel, but that stem from a Christian theology, which Jews, and I think religious Jews in America, embrace, besides like views about abortion. And I'm curious if those things, which are directly linked to the Christian theology, should be something that Jews should stay away from. Those are my questions. Not good for you.
I don't know if we're supposed to open, but I'm going to quickly answer and use this as a chance. I'm not going to answer the Kohanim and the converts, which is a very important question, but I think it's going to take us way too far afield. I think it's more about attitudes towards non-Jews. It's not about Avodah Zarah. I'm going to bracket that. You can all come back next year. That'll be the topic for next year. The wine issue, look, there are two issues about the wine, and this gets to your point about Christmas and Halloween. There's the Avodah Zarah concern, and there's the sort of socializing intermarriage concern. All right, you know, we do not have, whatever, it'll have to be, that's also for next year. But I will say that the Ramah basically acknowledges that once we say that Christians are not themselves Ovdei Avodah Zarah, that actually does allow for definite leniencies relating to wine, especially when it's not directly touched. And those are important, and those are practical and can come up. So there are definitely leniencies that I think that people, I'm not advocating for, but are definitely available b'di'evid because of this more nuanced view.
Was the final question you said?
About theology and
politics. I don't know where to begin with that, but I don't see that as problematic. I do want to sort of, I mean, you can accept the positive byproduct of the theology without having to buy into the theology, although maybe you are concerned of a slippery slope. I do want to say the concern you raised about Christmas and Halloween, what you really were expressing was different than the Avodah Zarah, was B'chukoseihem. And the B'chukoseihem concern, don't go in the ways of the non-Jews, I think exactly speaks to your concern of the losing of the clear demarcating boundaries, assimilation. You said it very beautifully. There's something there that I'm not getting, that I'm attracted to. I do want to make it clear that my concern with Avodah Zarah, with like going into a church, is different. It's not a concern, again, as I said before, of I might be drawn after it. I mean, it's rooted in a halachic issue about defining Avodah Zarah and so on, but it's also a concern of losing a sense of, like, as I said before, about just a concern of relativism and losing a sense of sort of my own deep theological convictions. I'm going to just end by a quick question to Rabbi Sperber and a line that I can never resist quoting my son, who is the biggest theologian of the family. So my question to Rabbi Sperber is, I've heard Rabbi Sperber, you share that about Hinduism before, and the only question I would ask is, if you took 1 million Hindus and asked them the same question, you know, what percentage of them do you think would give you that answer, and what percentage of them would you think would actually say that they do believe in multiple gods? And so I just want to be careful about assuming that we can take the position of the intellectual elite and allow that to define the entire religion. And that's a question towards you. And just the line from my son, because you mentioned that you find Christianity or Catholicism more problematic. I remember I was once having a conversation with my son about, you know, the importance about pluralism and so on and respecting other people from where they come from. And I don't know why I was telling him this, because as you'll hear in a minute, he was more along that way than I was. Anyway, so I said, you know, but if I'm being totally honest, like, I would have to admit that, you know, there's something about Catholicism and God taking human form that just strikes me as, like, deeply pagan. To which he said, so what's the matter with being pagan? So.
The question you asked me about 1 million Hindus. It's a sort of tricky question, because you couldn't ask that question in English. And if you speak the local languages, let's say Hindi, which I spoke quite well at one time, or if you use the Sanskrit terms, you would use certain terms. You would ask them about the Deva or the Devati or the Devi, which of course is the root of the word Deus and the Greek Zeus, divine. So we mistakenly think that a Deva is a god. The Deva is not a god. If you know Sanskrit sources, and they, if you're speaking any of the local languages, they will think that you're talking about something like angels. I don't know if you believe in angels, but, you know, they're all around in Jewish sources, and they're flying around. They're there, and they seize people's hands in order that they shouldn't slaughter their sons. So, I think that's the answer to your question. Your questions are very difficult because they're very pertinent, but you see, they fall into a broader category. You ask about Kohen v'Gioret. Ask the same question about Kohen u'Megureshet. Ask the questions, but it's a category of questions. What about the question of Mamzerut? So here you're entering a difficult field where we're dealing with established halakha, which is very difficult to reinterpret, and it's very difficult. And if you say that we have to have limits, hagvul lefanecha, as the Midrash says, then of course that is one of the gvulot.
the difference to me is that grisha is said in the Torah, but zona is said in the Torah, and that's an interpretation about our views about non-Jews. I feel like there is a slight difference.
You could go even further and say the gershin itkayer kekatan shenolad dami, and therefore how can it be a zona, and how can they have any other earlier relationships?
I'm willing to say anything you want.
But say this, so...
Next year.
I do want to leave time for questions. I'm sure there will be many questions. We'll try to do two rounds of questions. I apologize if we don't get to your question. The panelists, I think, will be willing to stay for a few minutes afterwards if you want to approach them. But let's take about five questions. We're going to try to pass the microphone around so that everyone can hear the questions, and then the panelists will feel free to respond to some combination.
This is for any of the panelists. I keep hearing this two-part definition of Avodah Zarah, but I think that nowadays there's something a little bit more hard to pin down, spirituality. The use of like incense and crystals and all sorts of sage burning and things that don't really fall into worship per se, but are part of spiritual practice. So I'm curious, like, could somebody use sage burning or crystals as a way of worshiping God, the one God that the Jewish people believe in, and not have that be a modality of Avodah Zarah? Or is that just so incredibly entrenched in paganism that it can't exist?
I've got two comments. One is to you about the period just before now, when the presidents were beginning to see the need and the reality of acknowledging minority religious ethnic groups, and inclusive, say, of Jews in particular, and Muslims, and in holiday periods with celebrations in the White House. And I think that the majority of American Jews were very proud of that. And that, to me, I think that they feel was a major goal of the original ideas in the early constitutional period. And so I have to disagree with you on what you've said. Now, I have an interesting problem with what the rest of you have presented, and that's Avodah Zarah in Judaism itself. And the example I'm going to give, there's a very, very famous printing shop on Meir Shearim Street that prints iconographic materials. And I would go to that man for many years to buy iconography, Jewish iconography, and particularly Chabad, with the Rebbe and the house. And I went recently because I wanted to do a portrait of the crucifixion of the Rebbe as Jesus and the two thieves. And I wanted to go to this man to get the Rebbe picture. And he said I could not find a picture of any kind of the Rebbe or any of these. And he said, yes, I'm a Chabad person, and I decided that all of my work of the iconography of the Rebbe is Avodah Zarah.
Alan Brill is an American professor who does deal a lot with Hinduism. That's just to take it off of the Israel context. But my question is, what? And you can find him on his blog. My question has to do with holy envy, a concept of developed by Bishop Christer Stendahl of the Swedish Lutheran Church. What do you envy in another religious tradition? What do you envy in Catholicism or in Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam?
Rabbi Rachel delineated a Havdalah, very strong Havdalah, between secularism and Avodah Zarah. So my question is directed to Rabbi Sperver, Rabbi Linzer. Do you buy that line, that separation, or do you believe that within secularism there is that potential possibility or maybe even likelihood of the development of Avodah Zarah?
Thank you for being here. This was awesome. Practical question. Very close family member of mine. He's very worried. He's a rabbi, and he can't figure out this. And we have Talmidei Chachamim up here. His brother, another family member, is marrying someone who is not Jewish of the Christian faith. He doesn't know what to do. Does he go to the wedding? If he does go, does he take his family members? And if he doesn't go, is it a Chilul Hashem versus if he goes, is it a Kiddush Hashem?
I don't know what to do. You start.
All right, fine. Do you want to start? Okay, fine. All right. Spirituality, I think that's a great question. You know, I don't think that there is anything per se wrong with all of those things. If a very particular mode has a very particular history and association with a certain type of a practice that could be an issue of bichukosehem, you know, it's a great question. I never actually thought about that. Like, if it works for me to burn incense, you know, I guess I would also ask about, is it part of a bichukosehem concern has to do with motivation. Like, if it's like, oh, because I want to sort of be like this new agey type of a thing, as opposed to like, no, I actually think this will just help me, you know? So anyway, I definitely think that there's a place for that. That has to be sort of like, you know, figured out in terms of the specifics. But I definitely think that there's a place for that. And it's, and maybe that's a good transition to the holy envy question, because if you ask me, and this is going to, and maybe, I don't know, maybe this will reveal something subconsciously about everything I've been saying. But if you ask me what I'm envious of, you know, I think that I think that Hinduism is much more sort of embodied and passionate and connected. You know, I think, because I think the challenge that Judaism presented to the world is a God that is cannot be imagined and cannot be imaged, and therefore is hard to relate to. It becomes very abstract, and you know, we had the Korbanot, and a lot of people have, you know, discomfort with that. It becomes very disembodied, and it's very hard to feel very connected as physical beings, you know, in our worship. And I think it also makes our whole religion more intellectual and less like passionate and less, you know, embodied, visceral. So that's certainly one thing I would point to. And in Christianity, in a similar way, you know, and this is the issue about are we always speaking, you know, praying to the same God? You know, I mean, Tosus already says they speak about God the Father, where it sounds like we're all talking to the same God. But a lot of times, you know, they pray to Jesus. It's a lot easier to pray to Jesus than it is to pray to God, you know, because the idea of somebody that basically I can imagine and looks like me, and it, you know, and it creates a certain sense of a connection. I mean, that's what we give up by rejecting all of that physicality. And I think that Christians talk about God a heck of a
lot more than Jews. Jews talk about Torah and Halacha. They don't talk about God. I think the only word that is less said in a sermon than God is sin. So, I didn't really understand the question about secularism and the intermarriage question. I think that that's a question much more about seeming to condone intermarriage than the question of whether it occurs in a church. A close colleague is getting married in a church and so on. Those are the issues we discussed before. The intermarriage, I don't care where it's occurring, that's a different type of a question. And the challenge there is figuring out, based on the circumstances, how do you show that you are still there for the person, you love them and so on, and at the same time, you don't necessarily condone their choices. And that has to be figured out based on the specifics and the circumstances.
I agree with the last thing you said.
Okay. But not with anything else.
I don't think that we spoke about idolatry in Judaism at all. What we said was that there were different ways of interpreting the texts and that there was an important difference of opinion between certain medieval commentators on how we interpret the texts. And there was also a philosophical complex question. Maimonides seemed to suggest that God could not take on any sort of physical form which would limit him in his abilities, which is contrary to the very basic notion of godhood. The other said, no, as he can do anything, he can also appear in some sort of physical form. Or some people reinterpreted it as saying that he would appear to us, to humans, as though he had appeared in human form, as in the prophecies of Ezekiel and so on and so forth. But we weren't talking about actual idolatry within Judaism. We were talking about understanding the texts in different fashions. What do I envy? First of all, I envy people that really believe in their religion and that they live by it. We, as you said very correctly, are very intellectual. I lived in India, and I go there a lot. And people live the religion. They will talk to you about how this is the place where Krishna came. This is the place where so-and-so took place. They see this as something almost visible. They're living a religious life. At Kumbh Mela, 100 million people come to the Ganga to bathe in the polluted waters, one of the most polluted rivers in the world. And they drink it. And they say it's purifying them. Amazing. That is the strength of real faith. They say the water is pure. When we drink it, it's pure. So they see divinity all around them. We don't really do that. We go to shul and we daven a few times a day, and every now and then we sort of think about it. But it's not something that's totally all-encompassing in our whole life. It's not just with them a matter of ritual. It's a matter of their whole way of thinking, their whole way of understanding, their whole personal status and identity. And as I said in the very beginning, there's a totally different mindset in the East from that of the West.
Okay, I had some time to think. It was too much pressure before. Amalia, your question was really great, and when you asked it, I saw my gut reaction was like, no, why would you, like, this is my gut, and I see how much the idea of using these alternative practices, even if they aren't linked to Avodah Zarah, sort of seems foreign to me and strange. And probably at my heart, I'm a traditionalist about just like going to shul and davening. And I'm always trying to think maybe I should try to open up myself. And that's one of the best things I learned from my students at Pardes, about they're so connected to other forms of spirituality that they bring into Judaism that is a reflection of Judaism. So I have to think about that like a little bit more. I guess I'd want to know what it looks like, and like I would want to try to understand it more, and how you think it brings you closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those are things I'd want to know. Can I answer one other question? I was going to answer two. Okay, quickly, about the wedding, my gut reaction, different than yours, Dov, is like, if it's family, for sure you have to go and bring the rest of your family. And I don't think we need to teach lessons to our family. Anyone who's intermarrying in a family that has other people who don't like intermarriage knows that those other family members aren't thrilled with intermarriage. I think, this is my personal thing, that you have to love your family members and be there for them and support them and care about them. And those are things you can discuss theoretically at other points, but you want their children to be connected to you, who are going to be Zer Yisrael if they're not halachically Jewish. And you just want to be involved with your family. And I think we can talk about things publicly about intermarriage and say things about the problems that are happening in the world. But for me, I personally don't think we need to make any statements to our family members. They sure as heck know what we really think in general. And we want to say, we love you and we care about you and you're part of my family. That's might be because these issues are close to home for me that I feel like that. But that's how I feel. And the last thing, I think it's so interesting that I wanted to say something similar to you. I'm going to say this because it's important to me. We've been saying this idea of Avodah Zarah and like seeing the divine in objects is the most distance, but yes, both of you said in some ways that was the most attractive thing to you. And I too wanted to say something similar, attractive because you thought it really connected you to the divine. And that's what's so interesting. I just wanted to point that out. I would have said something similar as well. I spend my whole life trying to see the divine in other people because that is a tenet I really want to live by. And I find it hard sometimes, but I imagine like if I could see the divine in a rock, it would be so easy to see the divine in another person. And I am envious of the idea that you could really understand that the divine is everywhere. And then I think we'd be much better at relating to each other. Okay, I finished.
As I'm passing it by, I'm going to just say, because about embodied ways, we used to actually in Sephardi countries to actually do like a full, or some of them, full prostration when we got to bowing down. And I would, you know, ask people, that is not even incense, you know, and that creates a much more embodied religious experience. So something to be thinking about.
Okay, I apologize for those who have more questions. I'm going to ask you to hold them for the panelists afterwards because I do want to end on time. Thank you so much for joining us on behalf of Yeshivat Chovei Torah and Pardes for this really fascinating discussion and the wisdom of our panelists. And I hope you will join us again on future occasions.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit almad.pardes.org.